From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman.
This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 350, recorded live Thursday, December 13th, 2012.
This episode is brought to you by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support, online at TELERIK.com, and by Franklins.net, training developers to work smarter, and now offering Gesture Pack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com.
In this episode, Scott talks with Michael Sarche about learning how to learn Git.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today on the show, I've got my buddy Michael Sarche. How's it going, sir?
It's good. How are you?
Not too bad. How did you and I meet, and what are we working on?
We met through Twitter. You tweeted something about your smallest .NET website, and you said the code sucks, and help me with that. And so I refactored some stuff for you and submitted a pull request. That's how we met, and smallest.net is what we're working on, and it's fun.
It is fun. I think that's a very very nice way of putting it. I think I said something more like, "May God have mercy on my soul for this code that I'm about to commit." I think I expressed that it was pretty horrible. Smallest.net, it's literally smallest, .net.com. We'd be cool if we could buy smallest.net as a domain, but it's actually smallest, .net.com is this little website that people can use. It'll tell them what the smallest download for .NET is that they can get. It'll detect what they've got, tell them if they're up to date. And I wrote it like in an hour 2 years ago, and it was basically a switch statement. And it was just horrible. And then Windows 8 came out, and then .NET 4.5 came out, and people started actually using this site. It gets like 10,000 views or something in a month. And I'm like, wow, this matters. And people emailed me that we need to update this. So when I put out the word, not only did I get, hey, I'll be happy to help you, which is always appreciated, but I got a pull request. And then I said, wait a second, I'm going to learn Git from this guy, because what do they say? Talk is cheap. Show me the code.
Yeah. You here's my Skype name. I need you to show me what you're doing. And you like call me at work. And then we had like an hour long session where I was trying to show you how to merge the pull requests and do rebases. And I think I had to slow down a couple of times to go back over stuff because I'm so used to it and I wasn't really aware of how much you had access to it.
Now, also, you're so politically correct. You're so nice. I had to slow down a little bit because you're an idiot, Scott.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, it's a tool. I mean, it's definitely complicated if you, don't know like what's going on. There's so the Git command line is not forgiving. I will definitely say that much. It takes some time, and there's a lot of good tools now, but they got to know the nuts and bolts a little bit.
Yeah, I have a love hate relationship with Git. I mean, I've been using it now for a couple of years, but I would not say I can do much more than, you know, committing, branching, making diffs, sending pull requests. Where I get really confused are rebasing and some of the crazy fast forward stuff. And I'm always still, even now, having to go off and Google for, for some of those commands where it's like, I was like, git reset hard head. I always like get that one wrong. And then the one where you go back in time two steps, I always have to look up what those are, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of a problem in general with Git. A lot of the commands, they look the same, but they do totally different things. Like the fact that I can name probably four ways to create a branch. Well, I guess there's only two or three, but I mean, the fact that it's just, you have to think about it. It's not just like, you know, you can do git branch, new branch name, or you can do git checkout dash b branch name, or, you know, you can pull down some new stuff from the server, or you can check out a remote branch differently. And it's just like, oh, well, which one of these do I want to do? And I think it's really just getting your head around all that is sometimes a large task.
Well, it's interesting because there are people, let's look at it in terms of programming languages. There are people who learn Ruby, and a few days into it, they go, wow, this is the language of my soul, right? I'm supposed to do this. And then there are those who learn C# and have the exact same feeling. And the same thing occurs, I think, with Git and Mercurial. When I learned Mercurial, I was like, oh, yeah, totally. You know what I mean? Like, even now, Mercurial just makes total sense to me. Totally get it. Awesome. You know, probably because it's kind of like Mercurial is distributed source control for people who like SVN. So it's almost like, you know, it's just totally intuitive. If you dug SVN, if you dug Subversion, it doesn't do that much more. And if all the all the commands are effectively similar. And then if you want to get into the crazy stuff, you can. But you can get a lot done without a lot of complications. But as soon as you get into Git world, it's almost like when you ask a Unix guy, you know, I just need to solve this one problem. And the Unix guy says, all right, well, let's start by writing this regular expression. And you're like, no. I just want to do this one thing. Okay, well, here's how awk and sed work. Well, can you back up a second? I feel like that with Git. It's like, okay, I want to check this in. All right, well, first we're going to rebase against the second. And it's like, oh, man, you can just check the code in. You know what I mean?
Yeah, actually, I learned Mercurial before I learned Git. And I think the big thing about Mercurial is not very big on letting you touch your history. So you commit something and you can't, like, if you want to undo it, you have to revert it instead of, like, Git where you can just, I just yank it out. And then, or rebase, which is a way of modifying your history in Git. That doesn't really exist in Mercurial. And if it does, I mean, I'm not aware of it because I only use it for like 3 or 4 months on a project. And I loved it. Like what you said, like the command line is just so much better. There's like merge merges, branch makes a branch, and, you know, reset resets your repository. That's all you have to do, unlike Git, where you have to like supply a commit hash or a branch name or something to point to what you want to reset to.
Yeah, exactly. So fun. I think that the source control that you spend time with the most before you are introduced to Git colors your relationship with Git, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and I actually started out, my very first job, I walked in and they were using SourceSafe, and I like died on the inside as soon as I realized I had to like check code out from a server. And stuff, and like other people could check it out, and I couldn't work for 3 days because they were out of the office and they didn't check their code in. That was always fun.
There's a lot of people still using SourceSafe.
Oh yeah, I'm aware. It's gotten a lot better, I've heard. I haven't touched it.
No, it hasn't. But the point is, the point is though that like there may be people who are listening to this who are like, oh man, I wish, you know, like, but at the same time, it did get a lot of work done. Like people got a lot of work done with SourceSafe.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not saying that as a Microsoft apologist. I'm just saying that as like, it was it. Like, after zip files, that was it for a long time, for Windows people at least.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can get work done. And we did like the project I was on and I got it like moved over to Mercurial, and then we used that. And then I went off to another job after that point. So
do you think that a new user should sit down with Git and learn the command line, or they should go and learn one of the kind of half-done GUIs that there are?
That is a great question. So I actually prefer people learning the command line first. And the reason for that is the GUIs are great. I mean, Git has a built-in GUI, the Git GUI, which is pretty functional. But they're not very forgiving if you don't know what's going on underneath. And without fail, even on the fancy GitHub for Windows, you will have to hit the command line at some point because you're going to have a merge conflict. And you have to know how to go in and, you know, continue a merge and run your merge tool and all that. And so I think learning the command line to know, like, okay, when I click the sync button, what's really happening? Like, am I pushing changes? Am I pulling changes? Is a merge going to happen? Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of learning the, even if it's a base one, like, I need to learn how to push and pull and do a merge and commit to command line is the best way. Because then when something breaks, you know, you can kind of look at the command line and say, okay, well, I can see my status and stuff here, or I can reset. And that's not always accessible via the GUIs that are available. So I think command line first, and then find a GUI that augment your command line usage is almost the best way to go.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the sync button. And when we say the sync button, right now the most well-designed or the prettiest or the kind of the premier Git GUI would be the GitHub for Windows client, which is optimized for the GitHub website, but you could take existing Git repositories and drag it in. So if you had a local repository, or if you were using Bitbucket or CodePlex, you could bring that Git repository down, drag it into GitHub, and there's this sync button. And I think that the fact that there is a button called sync, which is effectively the, you know, figure it out and get me completely up to date, but there is no single command line command that maps directly to that, is kind of proof that there's a problem with Git. You know what I mean? The GitHub for Windows guys said, we need a button that just gets regular people caught up, but it does a bunch of stuff in the background.
Well, yeah, what's interesting about that though is too is so if you're on a branch and you're trying to sync your branch and you're ahead and someone else is committed to that branch, it doesn't work because there is, as you said, there's no analog to the command line for that action, and it requires, you know, okay, you have to make a decision at that point in time how you want to handle that. And I think that's an interesting, and it's part of Git because you can modify the history in a lot of ways like that. So.
Right. And the sync button is fantastic and works perfectly until it completely doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
It just pops a dialogue. It's like, we're dropping you into the shell that you've never seen before. Get ready for it.
Yep. It's fun when people look at it and they go, uh-oh, there's this big red thing that says abort or open shell, and you just don't know which one to click sometimes.
Right. And then that's kind of the sad thing about Git is that they've done such an amazing job of hiding it with the GitHub for Windows tool. And then there's not even an off ramp. They don't slowly like back you down from the stuff they've been hiding. It just disappears. And it's like, all right, this abstraction has officially leaked and it's over now. Abort or open command shell.
Yeah.
And what is sync doing? Like often I just want to say, get me the latest stuff in whatever way possible.
So sync, I believe it does a git pull and then a git merge if it can. And then it also does a push. So I'm not exactly 100% sure of the order because I can't see that what's happening. But typically what you do if you want to sync your repository and without changing history is you would pull the branch from the remote repository, which could be, you know, another folder on your computer, GitHub or whatever.
So pull brings bring it
run
down.
Right? A merge. Yeah, so it brings all those changes in, then you merge those, and then you go through the merge, and then you push any local changes that are on the server up. So, like, you know, you're bringing in the changes that exist, and you're pushing them up. Or in the case that there are no changes, you would just run a push. And so that's what it's doing behind the background.
That's kind of the thing that you'd want to do all the time. I mean, that's what I do kind of every morning.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing too. I know a lot of people have that mindset where, you know, I've got to get my changes all the time. I'm not. If I'm working on something that's disconnected from what's being done, I don't seem to care because it doesn't matter.
Let's talk about that.
Merge in at a later date.
Let's talk about that because I think that at the beginning we said about how your previous experiences color your relationship with Git. I'm really obsessed with always being up to date, and that is probably because of a fear of a merge going bad, right? Because if I don't have to merge, then I don't have to face that fear. I just have to make sure that I've got the latest stuff, and my merges become very small and very non-scary. But it sounds like you'll stay disconnected for days, weeks?
Not weeks. I think there's a show a little bit back that you had about continuous deployment that as a mindset that I try to follow, which is get code in production, not necessarily features. So, like tested code and like fully working code, quickly. And so I tend to do lots of small commits throughout the day. So I'm like, I added these methods and they work. And so I commit those. And then, you know, if I get to kind of a stopping point where, you know, something's complete and it may not be the whole feature, like maybe I've only wrote the data access, I will go ahead and merge that into master or the branch or whatever that I'm on. And a lot of people, what they want to do is make sure that their branches always has all the changes. And so I feel like, well, I'm working on, you know, this feature A and other people are working on bug fixes or whatever. And as long as those bug fixes aren't associated with my feature, to me, it doesn't matter if I have them in my work, in my branch I'm working out of. Because at the end of the day, I'm just going to, hopefully, if your code is built properly or it's not, the churn's not super high, you can just go in and do a rebase, which is, you know, something kind of advanced, or you can just merge it if you don't mind merge commits, and there shouldn't be too many conflicts that you have to deal with.
Okay, so you've used the word like rebase again, assuming that people know what that means. Let's talk about that, because rebase seems to be like the first thing that someone learns that's kind of scary and makes no sense. You know, it's just words that it either totally makes sense to you, or to this day I still don't quite understand what a rebase does. But I know that that people use it like a weapon. You know, like Git users are like, "Oh yeah, I did a rebase." I'm like, "Oh god, what is that? You must be advanced."
So a rebase is a very low way of rewriting a history for a set of changes. So like a set of commits, rather. So that could be commits in a branch, commits against another branch. So let's say I have my master branch, and then I make what are normally called topic branches, which is like, you know, some branch for a specific bug or topic that I'm working on. And then someone's made commits to master. So my branch will point to the commit that master was head of at the time I made the branch. So that's like the newest commit on master. And then so people have added changes. So when I rebase, what I'm doing is I'm saying like git rebase, and then typically it's against master or another branch. And that just says find the newest commit on master or whatever. I'm just going to use master for this, and move the changes from the current one into that. So you're changing the base commit of your branch or set of changes to a new commit. So you could even go back. I think you could even go back in time. I've never tried that, but I don't see why not. But basically all it does is say, take the new changes and make my history reflect those.
Okay, so let me see if I understand this. I'll play it back to you, okay?
Okay,
We'll rebase the statement here. Okay, so me and a guy show up at work on Monday, and I make a branch of the work that he did on Monday. So I'm off kind of on a branch doing my own thing. He's on master. He does a bunch of work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. He's committing. Thursday comes along. He's got Thursday's work and Wednesday's work and Tuesday's work all sitting on master. I've been working off on Monday's stuff all this time. I have two choices now. I could merge my stuff in with master, or I could basically take the changes that I've added since Monday, and rather than applying them to Monday, I'll apply them and see if they apply to his new stuff on Thursday. So I kind of back up, you know, kind of unroll my stuff, hold on to it for a second, go back up to Thursday, and then play it back.
Exactly. So typically that goes really well, unless, like I said, there's a lot of churn, especially on the stuff that your branch is in. So like, let's say from Monday to Thursday, he doesn't touch anything that you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do a merge, then you'll get a merge commit, which is not a bad thing. It's just kind of a preference. Like some places don't mind merge commits. The place I work, we try not to have merge commits because they make reverting changes out of a branch kind of trickier.
So slow down. So a merge commit would be a commit that is just showing all of the results of the merge. So they tend to be big and messy?
No. So a merge commit is a specific commit that contains information to resolve any conflicts.
Mm.
Yeah.
So is it an auto-generated thing? It's not something like, what if I look at it in a diff tool, what's it going to look like?
It depends. So let's say that we have a small file. It's got a method, you know, method get people, and it's got some stuff, and you change something in it, and he changed something in it, and there's a conflict where you both change the same line, but there's no way to resolve that, you know, with normal methods. Like you both didn't, like one of you didn't rename a variable and the other one, you know, rename another thing.
Okay.
So a merge commit would say, you know, you get a three-way merge tool, like kdiff or beyond compare or whatever, and you would have to pick, okay, I want this line, or I want it, you know, manually make some changes. And those changes that you create in that merge tool are typically what show up. So it's like, okay, you know, he renamed this variable and I renamed it to something else. And so we had to pick one of those. So it'll have the correct diff there to, the patch rather, to make those changes. So it reflects the necessary patches to resolve any merge conflicts. is what a merge commit has.
And where can people get into trouble with this? Like, when is using rebase just a phenomenally bad idea and it's going to hurt you?
Rebase is a phenomenally bad idea if you're rebasing changes that have already been pushed to another repository.
And that's because other people are going to be basing all of their work on those commits that are now public.
Exactly. So you're affecting public history, which is bad, and affecting private history is not, because it's not anywhere else. And so there's a flavor of rebasing called interactive rebasing, where you actually are allowed to pick or modify commit messages or which commits are being rebased against another branch. And that's a really actually handy tool. So, for example, I do a lot of work in progress commits on my local branches when I like get up to go home at the end of the day. So I don't have those changes just floating on my machine. So let's say, you know, everything breaks in like I open Visual Studio and it rewrites, you know, a file for some reason. And I have a commit now where I don't have to worry about what happened. I can just get that state. And so I don't really want a work in progress commit on master, but I've committed it to a branch already, but it's a local branch only. So when I do a rebase, I'll either squash that commit into another commit, which means it's just combining the two sets of changes in those two commits into one, or I'll just I'll modify that commit message to say what I actually did if I realized that I was actually done.
That brings up another interesting question. I like to commit stuff a lot, almost maybe too much. It's kind of a paranoia because I just don't know what I'm doing and I just don't want to lose things. So I tend to commit anytime anything I don't want to lose happens. Anytime anything, that I would just go, oh man, I might need that later. So I'll just commit. I wouldn't say it's as bad as the people that do that, kind of habitual control S, that kind of the little twitch that we develop as programmers, where we just hit control S. But, you know, I do have a tendency to do that quite a bit. So my question is, can I, in Git, is it something that I could do where I could commit 20 times locally and then say those 20 really represent one that I want other people to see?
Yes, that's what a rebase is. So you, interactive rebase rather. So you do git rebase, dash I is the command, and it brings up a text file effectively that has, lines that look like hic, the commit hash, which is just the, you know, unique identifier for a commit, and then the commit message, the first line of it at least. And then what you can do is you can actually just, in there's things you can do. You can squash, you can just delete the line so you don't even use the commit if you don't want to for whatever reason. And then you can, you know, do some changes. And I think there's something else you can do, but I don't know off the top of my head, because I normally use pick and squash or delete a line. So you could actually squash all those into one commit. So you'd have one that was picked, and then you'd squash the other 19. And then you save that, and so it'll do that, and it'll pop up another dialog, let you modify all those commit messages into one, however you want. And so, yeah, that's a very common thing to do. Like, let's say you're fixing a bug, and you'd have 15 commits for a bug fix, and then you want to put that bug fix in master. Well, you could rebase those all into one commit and push it into master, and let's say you find out that, oh, that's actually, you know, causing another problem on master, in production. And so instead of having to go and revert 15 commits, you just revert one to revert that bug fix and then fix it on your branch and then recommit it. So that's a really good workflow. So I actually prefer commit early, commit often, because it's way easier to modify all your changes when you have lots of small commits than if you have like, oh, well, I've fixed these 23 files and I actually don't want to do two of them. And so you have to go through a lot of work to only add certain files to the stage and, you know, commit those and then reset certain ones. And I think frequent committing works out a lot better.
Now, if I do this squashing, does it squash it locally in the sense of if I looked at my local log, it will always be that way? Or is it only the result of the, I guess I'm trying to understand what happens on the server versus what happens on my local machine.
Yeah, so you're not squashing on the server, I guess. You never really want, like, you mostly want to do these kinds of things on local branches. You can do these kinds of things on a remote, but it's kind of dangerous. So, like, you'd have a branch, like let's say you have your branch, you know, my 20 commit branch, and you're about to push that to the server and you're like, well, I want to send 20. So you would rebase locally, and that'll actually turn all those into one commit in your local history, and you'll just see it as one commit. You won't see those 20 commits anymore.
Ah, I see.
Clear that up? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. I'm getting there. I'm a little slow, but I'll figure it out. How long did this take you?
Take me to do what?
To, like, figure all this out.
Oh, I don't know. I just, like, I learned, you know, all the basic stuff first, and then I would run into a problem, and I'd Google it or get on Stack Overflow or programmers or a chat room and bother someone and be like, what command do I need? I don't know what's happening here. And a lot of it's the Google foo of being able to know what you're searching for and get. Mm-hmm. Like, what just happened? Like, I lost a commit. Like, how do you find that? Because, you know, everybody has their way of doing it sometimes, it feels like. Figure out which one to write. And so it's just a lot of, like, it was a lot of, oh, no, I just broke something. Mm-hmm. How do I fix it? And then figuring that out. And then just doing it a lot every day.
And is it true that you really can't lose a lot of stuff with I mean, if it's committed, is it difficult to lose things, or can you really shoot yourself in the foot quite easily?
You could shoot yourself in the foot if you deleted a branch without, you know, merging to another one. But I mean, if it's committed and you're not deleting branches and you're pushing stuff to some kind of centralized repository or other repositories, then it's really, really hard to lose stuff. And even in the cases where you do get rid of stuff, a lot of times you can still get it back with some, it's like called reflog, and there's a file system check one where you can like see dangling commits, which is all kinds of crazy town.
Dangling commits?
Yeah, it's what happens when you, like, let's say you check out a branch and then you, go, I don't know how it actually happens, actually. I just know it happens sometimes. Like, when you get in like rebases and merge states, sometimes commits get stuck around. They don't necessarily get removed if you like abort a commit, not abort a commit, abort a merge or abort a rebase. Mm-hmm. And so you can see them there, or, so that happens sometimes. So I'm not really sure exactly how it happens. I just know it does. And they're not, it's just like lost in the Git index, which is, it's not lost. It's just still stuck in the Git index, but it's not inside. It's not, associated with any branch, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's just a commit that has no home.
Oh, a commit that has no home. I see. Okay, I try to put it in the context of file systems, right? Because it really is just a file system. That's the clever thing about Git. And you know, the times happen where you lose a file. Even as a technical person, you lose a file and you're wandering around in your hard drive looking for it. And you're like, how did it end up in there?
Yeah. Well, that's the one nice thing about Git too, is you can always find a file with not a find file, find a commit by its hash a lot of the times.
Right, because every commit has a unique hash associated with it.
Yeah, so I mean, you can move anything from any branch to another branch with it if you know its hash.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. One of the things that I've been most happy about in learning Git with the project that we're working on, smallest.net, was that we hooked it up on Azure and then set up the hook on GitHub. So when we push to master on GitHub, it automatically publishes. And I think this is a thing that Heroku did a couple of years ago. And everyone kind of thought that was awesome. And now that seems to be the standard way of putting websites live, I mean, at least simple ones. It's just you push it up to master and then Git will go and notify Azure that it's changed.
Yeah. I do really like that. I'm not sure if you're trying to ask me a question in there or if it's just my opinion. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, no, I like that. There's a ton of hooks. GitHub has like a mountain of them.
Is that something that you've done a lot of? Do you do that in like for real sites and not just toys like ours?
Ours is hooked into TeamCity at work. So TeamCity monitors our repositories on GitHub. And so we use organization private repositories on GitHub at my company and the place I work. And that's all. So TeamCity monitors it and TeamCity builds it anytime there's a new commit. And then we actually use Octopus to deploy post that. But, yeah, so I mean, Git hooks are really awesome. I actually, use HipChat with some of my coworkers for just on the side talking and remembering of conversations. And they have hooks where you can hook up it to monitor Git repositories, so you're alerted to pull requests and commits and all kinds of stuff. So
what, it's really cool. What else could I do with a Git hook other than just deploy stuff?
There's all kinds of stuff you can do. GitHub has, I don't know how many integrations, like it integrates with like, obviously GitHub issues. You can integrate a lot of it with, issue trackers, where if you like, you know, put a flag that of some form that, has the issue ID, it'll say this has been, you know, resolved or mentioned in this commit, and you can do the code and all kinds of crazy stuff you can do with Git hooks. It's pretty much open to the world, I guess, because they have GitHub as an API. Git hooks are mostly in GitHub, I think, for the most part, and Bitbucket has a bunch.
I guess it's because it is a hook. Literally, I could have it text me, or I could more than just deploy. I could have other processes like a build process or
A build process. Your unit test could run all that stuff. Continuous integration. I actually have a. I use Zapier. That's ZAPIER.com. Their free account gives you like 5 hooks. It's like if this then that, but for APIs. And they actually send me a message over Google Talk every time someone commits to a repo that I am active in.
Oh, really? Well, that's a clever thing.
Because I have HipChat, which I mean I use my computer and my phone. But the Android application is terrible. When you turn it off, you log out, it'll still send you notifications, which is not what I want, because I get a lot of messages in there.
Right.
And so I use Google Talks one, and then it'll ping me with stuff. And that way I can see, you know, if someone's got a pull request I need to review at work, or someone's committed code to a repository that I'm interested in at work. So I use that because it pops up and says hello. And you can have it send you emails or text messages and all kinds of stuff.
So give me some online resources that you recommend. And I mean, anyone can go and Google for learn Git, but what do you think people should do online to learn how to do this?
Yeah. So, if you really want to learn about Git and you want to learn everything, gitscm.org, that's the actual main site for the Git project. It has a link to the Pro Git book, which is a really nice book. It's free. You can buy it if you want from Apress, I think. I think it's Apress or somebody. Actually, I'm going to double check that because I don't want to put you wrong here when I'm saying this. But it's got all the information about all the nuts and bolts that you want to get into Git. Also try.github.com. It's actually a part of Code School, but it's free, and it goes through just basic Git usage, and they have a bunch of advanced Git. TechPub has a good series called Mastering Git. I think it's like $15. And there's help.github.com, which has a lot of resources for just using Git and using GitHub. In my opinion, the best way is just to sit down and start working on some small project that you don't really need to invest your brain in the actual project, but using it to like look at how commits work and everything.
Very cool. I'm going to add all of those links to the show notes so people will find those up at handsomeins.com.
That's about it. Yeah, I think that's a good starting point. And then from there, just kind of, working with it and getting used to it.
Very cool. Well, thanks, Michael. I appreciate it. And I continue to look forward to working with you on our little side project, smallest.net, which I think people should check out because it even works on an iPhone. People should go and look at smallest.net on an iPhone just to see what happens.
Yeah, it's fancy. All right, Scott. I appreciate you having me on today.
Very cool. Thanks a lot. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.